shocking. That is one of the reasons. It was partly political, too, I think. But when a man says the things that Jesus says to Orthodox Jews, well, you see what happens, and you will see what happens in this parable. What is the terrible thing that the Orthodox people do because I mentioned I was going to do John 9, and although you haven't had any time to look it up, to me it's amazing a whole chapter can be given to this whole question of blindness. What happens to the people who refuse in this chapter to go along with orthodoxy? A terrible thing happens to them. Do you know? You're okay, I love having you here. It doesn't bother me. It's just like when a pastor is preaching and a little baby begins to go, and the pastor, you must have noticed, he's got a few notes. He's not reading, thank God. He's got some notes, and so his notes are giving him security, you see. You don't read sermons. I don't know whether my pastor does, because we have a pastor with us. Do you read your stuff, or do you just have a few notes?
Oh, I have it written out, so I know when
to You do? Well, you have to time it, too, don't you? That's one reason for writing out, that you're timing stuff. On the other hand, one of my great friends is Gordon Lathrop, and I've always been, he's a Lutheran pastor and professor and liturgist, and I've always been amazed the way Gordon, who was our pastor at PLU, could swing on the chandeliers. He was so imbued with his material and his love of the students and the faculty that he could do this. It's a very difficult thing to do, may I say. But it can be done. It can be done. Because if you have a manuscript, unless you can depart from it, who just departed from his manuscript to everybody's astonishment? A man in very high power in the United States. Just lately.
Bush?
Governor.
Ah, yes. The governor. Suddenly, the governor of Washington.
Gardner.
And I've had his kids at POU. His son came to us after two other colleges and came to POU and is a crack tennis player. And the governor also. And through the tennis, he was rehabbed. We have a very fine coach. And suddenly the governor abandons his speech and talks about the three teachers who saved him in school. And I thought that was wonderful. He was talking to teachers who were asking for more money, you see, because it is very difficult when you are qualified to be in another field that would pay you infinitely more. You have to be really devoted to what you are doing. But he did. It's very difficult the first time. And I can tell you all, you step out before the people and you, in the back of your head, of course, you have an idea of what you're going to say. You also have one of those wristwatches that have an alarm on. Does any one of you have those? They're wonderful if you're a speaker. Did you know you could get them? There's a wristwatch, and when you've done your 20 minutes, it lets you know. Isn't that a fortunate thing, you see? And you must obey it. You spend a lot of money on that watch. Well, today I thought we might start off with some, before I do the blind parables, and when they oppose orthodoxy, they are thrown out of the synagogue. Now, excommunicated. That is the most terrible thing that could happen to an Orthodox Jew. Do you remember? And I'm going to read part of the parable because I won't read the whole thing. It's very long because it takes a whole chapter. But what would that be parallel to in the old Roman Catholic Church? This is not done very much today. But I was brought up with fear of this. Do you know what?
Excommunication.
Mm-hmm. That is done very rarely today. In fact, I can't think of a recent example of that. And I belong to the period when we also had a book of list of books you could not read. But I don't. I asked yesterday, and I don't think I had the Roman Catholics because I was doing Introibo ad altare Dei, and I asked, Do I have a nice, sound, Orthodox Roman Catholic here? Not a single one. Oh, dear me. And that is what I am in my heart, but not in my head.
There aren't any nice sound ones anymore.
I've got it. I'm supposed to tell the tape man. This is Kate Monroe, and I'm doing a session with Elder Hostel on contemporary parables, basing my remarks on the parable of the healing of the blind man in John 9. I say it's a parable because I think it's included three different times. There are three different accounts of blindness. We don't need a Bible. We don't need a Bible. All you need is, unless you can't hear me. Now, if you can't hear me, you may need a Bible. But most of you, I've asked you already, and you said that you could hear me fairly well. But you don't need anything, not a thing. All you need is you and me. Do you understand? When you're having a conversation or a dialogue with a person, do you take notes or do you read? No. And you know, John 9 is all dialogue. It's one of the very few chapters where there's a coming and going all the time in conversation between the participants. And it ends up furious when they ask the blind man for the third time, are you healed? He is absolutely furious with them. It's a very dramatic chapter, and says, I have told you that this man healed me. Have you ever had a conversation like that? How about with your grandchildren? I have told you not to run in the street. Yesterday I said to a little boy at evensong, at evening prayer, I had a little boy right in front of me, and he would not stop. I just very calmly touched him. I was just behind him, and I said, if you cannot join in this service, remember we're putting children in an adult situation, mm-hmm. and that I sympathize with them too. That they're not in a normal world here. Holden is not. Holden is more like a cocoon in some ways in which people can rest. And I just said, I think you're going to have to leave. I think children can learn church manners, by the way. I know it's hard, and I sympathize, because I was brought up in the church where you didn't say a word or father saw you afterwards. but people say, oh, but that's a different generation. No, manners are manners in all generations. I don't go for that stuff. This generation is quite different. They're not. I think they're looking for the fences mm-hmm. That they can knock against and have a certain security. In fact, I talked to a mother of two youngsters who are now grown. I had a wonderful conversation with that mother last night, as one does at Holden. Holden is a place mm-hmm. of conversations. And she simply said, I didn't say, you cannot do it, but I went over the ground with them of what they wanted permission, and then drew back. But by going over the ground in a certain way, she had already influenced them, and because they loved her and respected her, that mother may have saved one of the children from death, because the child did not do what she was not supposed to do. I'm wondering if in our day and age you can think of any contemporary examples of the blindness of one segment of the population to another segment. And this blindness has led, 10 years ago, to one death. I call it a martyrdom. And it must be 3 or 4 months ago, to the death of 6 priests and their servant. What do you think I'm thinking of? Who was the martyr 10 years ago?
King.
King took. Mm-hmm. I certainly think that King was a martyr on this continent and in another continent. Have you heard and seen the movie, which I have not seen, of Archbishop Romero? Oh, okay. Yeah. Now, Romero was a conservative, and it was the poor, poor people in El Salvador who evangelized him. This sometimes happens. Mm-hmm. And so he changed his point of view. And he came out against the government. And he was, of course, shot to death while he was celebrating. And then, much more recently, of course, you have the murders of the Jesuits, which you've all heard of. And it's in the paper now that they are really trying to get an investigation going. They've been very slow. I wonder if any one of you sees 60 Minutes. Mm-hmm. Because a month ago, I wish they would announce, by the way, what 60 Minutes is going to be about, because some of it isn't that good. But this one was very good. And it showed how people were frightened to say what they saw, those who had seen the murder. Now, it was blindness that caused this, you see. The people were blind to the sufferings of the people. This is not new in history. In France, what did blindness lead to?
Revolution.
A bigger
revolution.
The French Revolution, you see. There were absentee landlords, and not everybody was at the court, many of them were, and the peasants and the poor were suffering. And finally they could suffer no more. This terrible blindness. I've always thought one of the best ways of teaching this to younger people is, of course, The Tale of Two Cities. Mm-hmm. All of you have read it, because we're of the generation when we read Dickens and Thackeray and so on, and we memorized yards of stuff. And we hated memorizing, but we did it. And now we have a sort of a platform that has formed our style and given us a leaping off place into some of the material I want to do today, do you see? It wasn't all bad, that learning by rote stuff. Maybe it had disadvantages, maybe it turned people off. Like I talked to a young student in the village, this will give you an example. His father is a professor, and his mother is a chemical analyst, and here he is at Holden. And he said, well, I'm thinking of going to school. And I said, oh, delightful, fine. He said, yeah, but I just have a GED, a general equivalency of a diploma. Maybe you know what a GED is. I used to teach GED in jails and prisons. And it is people who could make it, but something has happened. We don't always know, by the way. Situations are much more complex than we think. So I think really examples of blindness in our day are certainly, I would say, Romero and the Jesuits, and still today, to some degree, the position of black people. Look at us, Lily White.
Yeah.
It is not that Holden hasn't made enormous efforts to have a rainbow week with all people. You'll see that on the slides that you see. They've made tremendous efforts. And I've been here when we've had black pastors from Chicago who work in the inner city. We are making the effort. The great problem, certainly at university level, is qualifications. How many can go ahead and get their PhDs, you see? It's very expensive to get a PhD. And yet, I wonder if most of us are very comfortable around black people. I remember in one of the houses I lived in, the landlady, and I don't mind, of course I wouldn't think anything, I wouldn't, because I'm a refugee myself. Refugees have a different point of view, and I told you yesterday that's what I am. But she didn't want black people in her house. Mm-hmm. I had an apartment there, you see. What would the neighborhood think? Mm-hmm. Well, so what? What would the neighborhood think? But she had a very, very fragile ego, as most of us do. By the way, don't we look so strong, don't we, you know, and oh boy, we are not. We're as fragile as that orchid that she's talking about. And we too have been shattered and somehow have gone through a healing process only to be shattered again. This may happen over and over again. Now, the parable on which I want to base this, and then I want to do, so you have a little idea, I want to do some Beckett and some Tolstoy and something you all know, I think, but it has a lot about seeing. I heard the owl call my name. You all know it, do you? I heard the owl call my name. This is a book about death. And I'll explain it when I come to do the short commentary on this by Margaret Craven. It has sold in 7 languages and millions of copies. It was written about 1970. I heard the owl call my name. This simply means that the Native American Indians, when they hear the owl, they know somebody will die. And there is a terrible death at the end. And then I'm going to do the most difficult of all. Beckett is hard, and so is Tolstoy. Craven is a little easier, and Eliot is very difficult indeed. As some dear person said to me today, well, you know, about that Camus, and people have trouble because I'm not making it sound English. I could call him Albert Camus. I couldn't do that. His name is Albert Camus, and you can get used to that. And everybody has trouble with Camus because he's very pessimistic. Except in the part I did yesterday, The Kingdom. But Camus himself was in exile for years and years. He was a very, very poor boy. Who could have been blind, but he wasn't, in Algeria. But on that system, he was able to win a scholarship at the age of 11. Our education begins about 11, 11 and a half. And our, because English, German, the gymnasium, French, the lycée, it's all tough. And you sort of start working towards being... Do you remember what you were like at 11 and a half? Yes, you were good. Do you remember your grandchildren at 11 and a half? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they're just as good, but different. Do you see? Well, Camus won this scholarship in Algeria, went to the lycée, and then just when he was really getting going, he had TB and was put in the public ward in Algeria, and what he saw there is repeated to some degree in his very famous novel, The Plague, La Peste in French. And from then on, he was faced, it seems to me, with a kind of nothingness. And he did to some degree, but you have to be very careful with this, to get into the existentialist school, which simply says, I exist. And therefore I am. Whereas Descartes in the 18th century said, I think, therefore I am. Mm-hmm. But Camus didn't say that, and nor did the existentialist school. They said, I exist, I experience, and because of my experience, I am. So much of our modern writing is experiential. Much of our sermons are experiential, because that's all we have. That's all you have. Is the experience of 70, 75, 80 years, a very rich fabric that you're sharing all the time. And even playing the games. Didn't you find last night, you didn't have the campfire, but you played games. Mm-hmm. And somebody said to me, oh yes, but it led to a lot of sharing. And it does. And people love this. Particularly when they are like I am, they live alone, often in an apartment. They're internalizing a great deal. But they can't share all the time. And to come here and be able to share with all these people is, of course, I think, a great treasure. Now, this is what is said, partly, in Luke 9, and then Mark does the same thing, the healing of blindness, and Luke says this, in 9, very interesting thing Jesus says. We, not I, we must carry on the work of him who sent me while the daylight lasts. A great emphasis on the light in the New Testament. Night is coming when no one can work. I am the world's light as long as I am in it. And then Jesus does a dramatic thing. I've thought of this lots of times. He spat upon the ground. Just think, he's surrounded by a multitude of people. And he starts to spit. It's the only time he does this, by the way. He spat on the ground and made a sort of clay with the saliva and put it on the man's eyes and said, go and wash. What could the blind man have done? He could have said, no, I'm not going to do that. It's stupid. I've been blind for years, and just because you put mud on me and told me to go and wash, well, have you ever done that? Somebody says, go and do something. You say, no, it won't work. No, because obedience is extremely important as a channel for grace. I'm sure every morning you have devotion. Some of you never spend a day without listening, just listening. And sometimes you're told to do things, and you think, oh no, that won't work. No. But you go and do it anyway, or you don't, do you see? And the man obeys. Because this parable is a teaching parable, and there are several things here that I think we all can learn. So the man obeys and came home with his sight restored. When we obey, my great, I will tell you right away, my great area of obedience is not to be a workaholic. I love to work. I have a passion for work. I must be escaping from something. Anybody will tell you that. A workaholic is a kind of an obsession. What am I running away from? I have an idea, but I won't tell you now. His neighbors and people who had often seen him as a beggar said, isn't this the man who used to sit and beg? Yeah, that's the one. No, very like him. I'm the man, all right. Then how come your blindness is cured? Oh, the man called Jesus made some clay and smeared it on my eyes and said, go and wash. So off I went. Now I've got my sight. And then the very natural question, it's a question we all ask, where is he now? Mm-hmm. Of course, he's right in the room. See, after the resurrection, the Spirit is here. And Jesus says also, the kingdom of God is within you. We're all, as I said yesterday, although I know it might be heretical, I think we're all incarnated. And then I always have to say with a small I, so I don't offend anybody. Where is he now? I don't know. So they brought the man who had once been blind before the Pharisees. I wonder why they did that. Why didn't they let well alone? Can you imagine why they did that?
Teaching.
I think so too. The Pharisees are the teachers. The Pharisees are the people in authority, aren't they? And so they're kind of checking it out with the people in authority and thereby teaching them. We do that too. If you've ever been in teaching, have you ever found yourself saying, I'd better check that out with the principal? Have you ever done that, you teachers? Or have you said, I hope the principal doesn't notice? I have done that. This happened to me once. I was teaching a class, this was in Tacoma, and a student said to me, what happens if the priest drops the host at the Eucharist as the people are kneeling? And this is perfectly possible. Hosts can slip off patterns unless you're using a ciborium. It was on the floor. And so the student said, because I was the authority, you see, in this case, what do you do, Mrs. Monroe? And I said, well, I expect the priest picked it up. She said, he didn't. It was still there. Very interesting, because of the sacredness, you see, of the Eucharist in not all denominations, but this is the real presence of the body and blood of Christ. This is one way. There are many ways, by the way, of looking at the Eucharist, but in some denominations, this was it. And she said, he didn't. So I said, well, what about it? And she said, well, I've got it in my pocket. Now, what would you have done? I simply said, I think I'm in a state of grace. I shall receive while you pray. And I did. Ah, but I couldn't let it go at that, because this is something that lay people don't do. Increasingly, we do have Eucharistic ministers, but not then. And of course, I went to the next authority, because I didn't want to get around in the school that Mrs. Monroe had desecrated a host. You had to be careful with this kind of stuff. So I said to the principal, well, I did this. And she said, oh, you did the right thing. See how important it is to go to the Pharisees, how important it is to check it out. So they brought the man who had once been blind before the Pharisees. And they asked the question, how come you see? He put clay on my eyes. Now I can see. And then the Pharisees say this, this man cannot be from God. But there's the strangest reason. I don't know how many of you mix up the institutional church and going to church with being a deeply religious person. It's a very dangerous thing. The institution can become fossilized. Have you ever said to somebody, did you go to church on Sunday? Did you go last Sunday? And they say, no, our family doesn't go to church every Sunday. We have time together. And you can be shocked by it or you can accept it. The Pharisees would not accept it. And they say, this man cannot be from God since he does not observe the Sabbath. Would you agree with that? I don't think any one of you would. The observation of coming from God, of being filled with the Holy Spirit, has very little to do with the Sabbath, except the Sabbath is a community. More and more we are emphasizing the horizontal aspect of the church. It used to be sort of me and God. Now, it seems to me, and I'm rather glad, we're getting the both worlds. And when you enter the church, you are a member of a living, loving community. And so it's a pity to miss it, isn't it? But it is not an institution. For too long, we have thought of an institution, certainly in my case, a hierarchy, beginning with the Pope, the cardinals, the archbishops, the bishops, the priests, the deacons. You know what I mean by hierarchy. And not all denominations are hierarchical. What is the least of all the denominations from the point of view of being non-hierarchical?
Quakers?
Quakers, I would say. Yes. And the second, Congregationalists. Each congregation, in many cases, is autonomous. And yet, these are strong Christian churches. But certainly, I think the Lutheran Church is hierarchical, because now we have, certainly in this synod, we have different bishops. I think we have three or four. And one of them is Bishop Wold. Maybe some of you know David Wold. I had his student, his daughters, and I've spoken in his church. A very interesting man who's head of our Board of Regents, where I am. So I would say the Lutherans are hierarchical. Would I be right in there?
I think so.
As long as you have bishops, you see. Bishops and pastors and deacons. I think so. I'm not sure. Certainly the Episcopal Church is hierarchical. No question about it. Think of the Archbishop of Canterbury. Mm. But how can a sinner give such wonderful signs? They were in two minds about him, just as we are. We're in two minds too. Finally, they asked the blind man, what do you say? I believe he is a prophet. And there is a prophetic ministry in Jesus. The woman at the well we did yesterday, she may have been a prophet recognizing another prophet. I say may because I've not done enough research on this. The Jews did not really believe that the man had been blind and then had come to see. So what do they do? The most natural thing in the world. Whom do they ask?
His parents.
Oh. Yes. Isn't that natural? They go to the parents. And the parents say, we know that this is our son and he was born blind. And then I love this. Why don't you ask him? Let him speak for himself. Well, this dialogue is so vivid to me and so natural. But why did they say this? This intrigues me. It reminds me always of Pontius Pilate. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews. How often we have a hidden agenda, but we don't like to let it surface because we might lose our jobs. Well, think of Nazi Germany. Many of them were not bad people. And not everybody could be a Bonhoeffer. They had children and families. I've often thought about this. They had to take care of them. You cannot be totally condemning Can you? And yet 6 million or more died. The Jews did not really believe this. And then it says they were afraid of the Jews who had already agreed that anybody who admitted that Christ had done this thing should be excommunicated. It was this fear that made him, his parents say, ask him. And of course they do. And he gets, the blind man, now seeing, gets absolutely furious. And it says, are you wanting to be his disciples too? Weren't you listening, he says? Why do you want to hear it all over again? He's fed up with them, you see, because he has undergone a tremendous conversion. Have you ever felt like that? You're talking to somebody out of your heart, and they're blind. They don't hear what you are saying because they are not listening. They're thinking of what they're going to say next. Have you ever done that? You'll be talking to somebody and you're thinking, now, in a moment, I'm going to get my turn. And I'll say something. I'm going to give you your turn, too, in a moment. You're the one who is disciples, who is his disciple. And, of course, you misbegotten wretch, they flung at him and they threw him out. You see, it's pretty savage, isn't it? It's as savage as, in a way, as the crucifixion. But if you step out of line, you are going to suffer. And of course, that's why I shall do Beckett later, because in Godot, they do not step out of line in Waiting for Godot. I'm going to give you a chance later on, and we can do some of it orally, to put down, because we've got a Thursday session and a Friday session, any parable that you've never really understood and you wish I would talk about, I think I know them fairly well, or any other topic to do with blindness and authority and the shattering of orthodoxy and the use, certainly, of authority. At this point, is there something, as I'm talking in this rather unorthodox way, that you would really like to question, something that you've heard all your life, and here I am saying things that, you wonder if I've gone off on the wrong track. Is there anything, and you're very free to do this, good heavens, is there anything you would like to point out that I have completely missed?
Yes. I've never put this in with the parables, I guess.
I know you didn't, and my friends said the same thing. I don't understand this, so I flew to Webster. The dictionary. I did not say it would be a biblical parable. I simply said parables and contemporary parables. Now, what is a parable? I'm so glad you asked that. A parable is any story that is written for instruction.
Yeah.
A fable is a parable, an allegory is an extended parable. Do most of you know Pilgrim's Progress, 17th century? That is an allegory, isn't it? The Pilgrim's Progress as he makes his way through despair and so on. And I think that's a very legitimate question. I thought a parable was just a story of a man who was in a ditch and all the correct people went off on the other side, and it was a Samaritan, who took pity on him, period. But I think it's like an onion. You have to keep peeling and peeling, and you never get to the core. Does that help any, I wonder?
I
sympathize. All your life you've done parables, haven't you? But I think that Jesus himself says, he's doing more than the event of one prodigal son who was welcomed back by his father. I think he is teaching through that we are all welcomed. It's a kind of a message thing, and it is not confined to 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
The contemporary theater is very parabolic, actually. Any other question? Good, I'm glad you did that. There may be lots more questions by Friday, and then we'll all get on the boat, and we may be leaving Saturday. You're all leaving Saturday, aren't you? I may. Where's my doctor friend? We may. We don't know. We're sort of... Do you ever find that you sort of play things by ear? You just you let it rest in the Lord, and if it's going to work, it's going to work. And you can do terrible things by pushing something. Agnes Sanford, the great healer who wrote The Healing Light, she says, if you get an urging, and I've found this to be true, not to take, if you're in the way, if you spent your devotional time, and you get a kind of urging not to do something, it may be better not to do it. But it takes a lot of listening, by the way, to do it. And even then, you may be deaf. You can't tell because of the complexity of the situation. The second account of this, with the same meaning, I think, is in Mark. In Mark 10, it says, they came to Jericho, and as he was leaving, accompanied by his disciples and a large crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, was sitting in his usual place at the side of the road. And he began to call out. Now, one thing I think we need to know in all this business of healing and praying and so on, there is a certain urgency in it. You feel that in the man who regains his sight in John, an urgency to do something different. When he heard it was Jesus, he began to call out, Jesus, have pity on me. And what do the people around him do? They say, shut up. And they do the same thing with the children. You notice this? It's very interesting that when you have somebody like Jesus, there's a strange feeling he's got to be protected. He's weird. His mother and his family say, you remember that episode? Because it starts in the temple when he's only 12. Come back. You're doing things that are going to lead you into danger. They want to protect this charismatic individual. And the people sharply tell the blind man to keep quiet. Now, he could have given up at that point. It's like a lovely passage where Jesus says, because the widow insisted she was listened to. You sort of have to put some passion into this thing. Isn't that interesting? You've all read this by now, haven't you? We have to have a passionate stance to life, I think. Of course, that may lead to prejudice. Many of the people told him to keep quiet, but he shouted, have pity on me. Jesus stood quite still and said, call him here. So they call the blind man. It's all right. Get up. He's calling you. And now look what he does. He threw off his coat, jumped to his feet, and came to Jesus. I love that, you see. He's vibrant. He's alive. He's not one of these, what do you want me to do for you? It's interesting that Jesus does not right away do anything. The man has free will. He has to, in this case, he asks. Because sometimes the people can't ask. Like the man let down from the roof. You remember? I think most of you know all this stuff by heart. I don't want to bore you, but one of the most interesting things in the New Testament is taking off a roof. Do you ever think about this? Now, of course, it was a slightly easier roof than this, and the people slept on those roofs. But and imagine the surprise of the people when this stretcher is plopped right down where the fireplace is. Do you ever think about this? I often wonder whether we imagine, visualize, image the Bible. What do you want me to do for you? Oh, let me see again. Go on your way. Your faith has healed you. He recovered his sight and followed Jesus. Now you see, he saw. But notice there's a lot goes before the seeing, isn't there? And unless we have passionate people like Romero, or like the six Jesuits, or like Martin Luther King, nothing is going to happen. And this is a lot of what Holden does. people come out of here and they enter their congregations, and sometimes people begin to listen. It doesn't always happen. And now what we're trying to do at Holden, they had an hour and a half meeting last night, some of you may have been there, talking about the youth. Is your congregation filled with young people, aged 15 to 20? Is it?
No.
Good for you, good for you. Some congregations are not. It depends on many things, because this is contagious, of course. But they're taking this very seriously here. We happen to have with us the coordinator of all these youth weekends, you know, the ebbing and flowing of youth on weekends from many congregations, even from Alaska, are coming. I started in with the fascinating discussion group, and then it continued, and I didn't realize it was continuing, so I didn't go. Before I plunge into a contemporary, I think I'm going to take another 10 minutes. Are you tired? If you want, I know these seats are awfully hard, and I certainly recommend that you do what people have been doing next door, bring in cushions. There's about 7 cushions. But in 10 minutes, we might just stand up and stretch, and then take another 10 minutes. We don't need to push it. Are you getting tired? Would you like to stand up? Yeah, good sir. Thank you. Let us stand up. Just stand up and stretch, after all. I don't want to take 10 minutes right now, because I want to do some contemporary before we... We should do this in churches, too. But you know what saves us in churches?
Hymns. Singing.
You must not sit down to sing. Lutherans always... Episcopalians, stand to praise. Sit to listen. Kneel to pray. And so that, you learn that when you're a little kid, although I wasn't raised Episcopal. Catholics do much the same thing. I have never sat down to sing in my life until I was asked to sing the Psalms singing, you see. Oh, you Elder Hostel people are going to get a chance to sing a part of a hymn. I told you all this on Friday. But I guess we may be sitting, because I'm not the worship leader. And we do what the chaplain says, after all. She's ordained, and I don't really have much to do with it. Okay, sit down again, please. All right. Now, I think I'll start with the most difficult, certainly one of the most difficult, is Beckett. Beckett is a revolutionary playwright who died last year. He wrote in French, although he was Irish, but he lived in France, as part of the resistance movement against the Germans for a great part of his life, as did Camus. These are people who went underground at great risk to their lives. And Beckett was part of the underground in Paris. How many of you know and have been puzzled by Waiting for Godot? Yes. It's the most puzzling thing you ever saw. It's a couple of clowns. And they're on a bare stage, and all you've got is a tree, and here they are leaning against each other, and it says Waiting for Godot. And the more I read it, I've read it many times, it seems to me it means waiting for somebody else to take the responsibility. They're in the middle of Nazi Germany. Everybody is waiting for somebody else to do something, do you see? Are we waiting in American politics right now?
Yes.
We are in a democracy. You all have the vote. You always vote. You don't always like what's going on. I wonder if you constantly write letters to Congress and so on. I used to belong to a group called Results, and they were anti-famine, and they were always writing to congressmen. Right there in the meetings, we wrote and stamped, and the letters were mailed right there. Urging more provisions for Ethiopia and places like that. Well, this is what Beckett says, one of the only two clowns at this point. All my lousy life I've crawled about in the mud, and you talk about the scenery. Look at this muck heap. I've never stirred from it. You and your landscape. Don't touch me. Don't question me. Don't speak to me. Stay with me. They look at each other, then suddenly embrace, clapping each other in the back. And then in comes a slave called Lucky, taking a whip in his mouth, totally and blindly obedient. And this is the little scene. Lucky says, "Nothing you can do about it, no use struggling. One is what one is. No use wriggling. The essential doesn't change. Nothing to be done. I can't go on like this." That's what you think. They do not move. And then a student of mine wrote this at the end. "God, the Pentecostal fire never breaks through the exile of waiting for nothing." Nothing. Have you ever felt like that? Nothing I can do about it. I hate the pressure of my school. I can't stand the principal. Nothing I can do about it. This is what I call severe depression. I didn't go into depression after my husband died, thanks to the church, really. But there's something, when you're in grief, when you have that sort of feeling, nothing can be done. I've done everything I can do. Nothing can be done, you see. That nothingness, which is a kind of blindness, because actually there are many things that can be done, but Beckett never saw, he never went into the world of the spirit that I know of. He spent his whole life in despair because of the terrible scarring of World War II. Like many of you, I'm sure, I wasn't in this country, you have been scarred by the Depression. But you've come out of it, haven't you? But you remember those days, don't you? But somehow the resiliency of your spirits and your spouses and so on, you were able to make it. But those were terrible days, people tell me, in the United States. Almost worse than anything we have known. The worst thing that I knew was when I was in England in 1947, they had a severe cold and a coal strike, C-O-A-L. That was 1947, and I was over there with my husband, and it was really absolutely paralyzing, but nothing could be done. That's how I felt in 1947. But of course, we bounce back. It's amazing, don't you think, the way people do bounce back. Well, then, here is another case of blindness, which is redeemed. These are also redemption stories. How many of you know Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Ilyich? You'll get a bibliography at the end. Have you ever heard of this? It's a genius story. And it's a story of a very prosperous man. In some ways, but lesser ways, it's like The Death of a Salesman. You remember, who wanted to be popular? Whereas The Death of a Salesman is excellent. You don't confuse Tolstoy with Miller. And here, this prosperous man who seems to be going along just fine in life gets cancer. And it is only towards the very end, within 2 hours of his death, that he sees. And because it's Tolstoy, needless to say, the writing is masterly. And this is what you get at the very end. "At the end of the third day, 2 hours before his death, his schoolboy son had crept softly in and gone up to his bedside. The dying man was screaming. His hand fell on the boy's head, and the boy caught it, pressed it to his lips, and began to cry. At that very moment, Ivan Ilyich fell through and caught sight of the light, and it was revealed to him that though his life had not been what it should have been, this could be rectified. What is the right thing?" And he grew still, listening. "Then he felt that someone was kissing his hand, he opened his eyes, looked at his son, and felt sorry for him. Yes, I am making them wretched, he thought. They are sorry. Besides, why speak? I must act. He indicated his son and said, take him away. Sorry for him. Sorry for you all. And suddenly it grew clear to him that what had been oppressing him and would not leave him was all dropping away. He was sorry. He must act so as not to hurt them. How good and how simple! And the pain, he asked himself. What has become of it? Yes, it's there. Well, let it be. And death? Where is it? What death? There was no fear because there was no death. In place of death, there was light. So that's what it is, he suddenly exclaimed aloud. What joy! He saw. Isn't that wonderful? But notice, you remember the very first day I gave you Auden, you will find him in the kingdom of anxiety. Do you remember that first poem that I could almost put at the beginning of the bibliography? It is only at these moments I'm becoming more and more convinced that we see, and I begin to see you, and I mean really see you. I've had some wonderful conversations since I arrived here. There was one conversation I regret I did not have. And it was a conversation that some of you may have seen, this is anonymous so I can tell you this, with a young man who was on our boat, because many of us were on the boat, and he was carrying a guitar. Did you notice that young man? I missed the boat on that one. I should have gone up and spoken to him, but I thought, stupidly, he was just going up to Stehekin. He wasn't. He was coming here. But he had not been very well. He'd had some kind of a virus. And so when he got to where we all got off, he turned back. He never came. But there was a sequel to that that I thought was even more wonderful. So somebody from the boat mentioned it, and immediately somebody from the administration got on the bus going back down and found the young man and tried to persuade him that if he would come, we were able to take care of things. We had a nurse in the village. It would be okay. But it was very sad to me, as I was told the story. Then the boat began to pull away and they could no longer talk together, and he went back to Chavannes. Don't worry. Don't worry. The seed has now been sown. And he was told that maybe in the fall he would come back. But wasn't that a moving thing, you see? That I think not one of us here, maybe some of you did talk to the young man. I usually do. If I see people with musical instruments, it often means Holden, because there's a lot of music around here. This time, I simply didn't. I was talking to some of you and reading and doing very little. Now, why don't we take... should we just take, you can take, it's 12:05, let's take 5 minutes, should we, and then come back, and when you come back, I would like to see you a little longer to do Craven and Elliot, okay? So I suggest you go out and breathe for 5 minutes in the mountain air. We'll take 5 minutes. I'll start again.
Shall we begin?
Okay. Now, you know what is wonderful about all you people? Unlike when you're teaching, say, juniors or seniors in the university, if you give them a break, some don't come back. But I think that's very natural. And they'll say to somebody, oh, take the notes for me or whatever. And I don't say anything. They already had 45 minutes. And so the end, and by then they know. Also, I have a feeling that when people don't show up, they're conveying a message to you. You see, you don't have to speak to tell people things. As we see in the blind man, it's what he does. Well, this is a book. When I talk about it, you'll say, oh, yes, I know that. I saw the television program. I heard the owl call my name. It just happens that it's absolutely misleading, because the television program emphasized the romantic element between the Indian girl and a white man. That is not the main emphasis of this, but for television, they just had to do that. This is basically a story of a young man. He's about 27, and he's blind to any real experience of life. He has been ordained, and his bishop knows. It's odd how cancer comes into so many of these things. His bishop knows that he has cancer. Do some of you begin to remember it? Anybody remember this by now, as I begin to give you the background? No, it may be just something that you didn't hear of. I heard the owl. And this is how it begins. The doctor said to the bishop, so you see, my lord, you know, in England we call them lords, and this is in Canada, same thing. You see, my lord, your young ordinand can live no more than 3 years and does not know it. Will you tell him, and what will you do with him? The bishop said to the doctor, yes, I'll tell him, but not yet. If I tell him now, he'll try too hard. How much time has he for active life? A little less than 2 years, if he's lucky. So short a time to learn so much. It leaves me no choice. I shall send him to my hardest parish. I shall send him to Kingcum on patrol of the Indian villages. Then I hope you'll pray for him, my lord. A wonderful Indian village stuff in Seattle at the Anthropological Museum, if you happen to live in Seattle. And most of the stuff is from the Kingcum village, so I recognized it. Then he comes by working with the villagers, not talking to them, but being with them, essentially. He comes to know himself and to know them. And it says, he went slowly up the river. In front of the vicarage, he anchored the boat and waded ashore. He trudged up the black sands to the path and stopped. From the dark spruce, he heard an owl call, once and again. And the questions that had been rising all day long reached the door of his mind and opened it. He went up the path and the steps, through the living room, into the kitchen. The lights were on. At the stove, Marta, the old Indian woman, was preparing his dinner. Marta, something strange happened tonight. On the bank of the river, I heard the owl call my name. She did not say, nonsense. It was my name the owl called. I am old. With me, it does not matter. She did not say, it is true, you're thin and white, but who is not? It has no importance. She turned, spoon still in her hand, lifting her sweet, kind face with its network of tiny wrinkles, and she answered his question as she would have answered any other, and she said, yes, my son. And he dies. This is a real person, by the way, because I met a nurse who was in the village when this vicar was there. He does not, in real life, die of cancer. He dies in an avalanche. And the ending has such echoes in it of what happens afterwards. Then the men of the tribe waded into the icy water to meet the canoes, each man taking his turn carrying the body of the young vicar, while the women sang an ancient hymn to the Supreme Being, whose existence had been sensed before the white man had ever come to this land. And when the body had been prepared for burial, six men carried the box into the church, the tribe waiting there. They placed it on trestles before the altar, and T.P. the elder took his place at the lectern, which was the golden eagle, and spoke the Lord's Prayer, joining him. In the night, the only light in the village was that from the lantern which Jim had placed in the little church. The village was quiet and at peace. Walk straight on, my son. Do not look back. You are going to the land of our Lord, said Marta. In the last house of the village, Peter the carver lay awake also. He remembered that in the old days, when a great chief died, his soul came straight back to the village in the body of a raven. Peter did not believe this literally, yet it seemed to him the soul of the young vicar would return to the village he had loved, and surely it would be most inhospitable if no one was awake and waiting. Thus he dressed and sat on the top step of his house in the dark, and hearing the rustle of some small night creature, he spoke softly. It's only old Peter the carver who waits here, friend. Past the village flowed the river, like time, like life itself, waiting for the swimmer to come again on his way to the climax of his life and to the end for which he was made. The swimmer is really the salmon that comes up to spawn and then dies. And there are parallels here that the young vicar has come up, he has laid his gift, and he dies. If you want to go to your public libraries, I don't think you can find it. You may be able to find it in paperback. I really recommend this book. It has terrific echoes. And it's He That Shall Hear, Let Him Hear.
And Catherine, is that titled I Heard the Owl Call My Name?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the author is?
Craven. C-R-A-V-E-N. Margaret. Margaret
it's
Craven.
I have read it too.
Oh, I'm glad. Did you like it?
Yes. But it was very sad.
It is very sad. You want to cry at the end because
he was so full of love.
And the part, I couldn't find it just before you came in, is a part where when he knows he's going to die, all time changes. The meaning of time changes. I may be able to find that and read it to you tomorrow. And then just two very short things before you go about why we are so blind. If you came this way taking the route you would be likely to take from the place you would be likely to come from, if you came this way in May time, you would find the hedges white again in May with sweetness. It would be the same at the end of the journey if you came at night like a broken king. Either you had no purpose, or the purpose is beyond the end you figured and is altered in fulfillment. That's what's so interesting. As you act, as you are fulfilled, sometimes you find the purpose of your life. How many of you, I wonder, just wandered into teaching or wandered into nursing? You didn't mean to do that, but you found your fulfillment. There are other places which also are at the world's end. And then Eliot says this, and this applies to all of us. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time. See, so one way to avoid blindness is to explore, which is exactly what you're doing. That you explore, and then you're going to go right back to your towns and villages, and you will see them for the first time. Isn't that exciting? Okay, let's go and eat. That's all. Oh, what about tomorrow? Well, but I know what I'd like you to do tomorrow. I thought about it. I'd really like you to think about a time when you came to yourself. Now, this is going to be anonymous. When did you suddenly come to yourself? You'd been pursuing a certain path, as the people have been telling me in the village. They suddenly realized that's not what I want to do. I'm going to take a year off, and I'm going to find out what I really want to do. When did you come to yourself? And then you always have to think of what were the circumstances, what were the people surrounding you at the time, what were the options open to you, and how you finally saw, and what were the results. Just think about it, would you? If you want to scribble down some things, and we can take some sharing time, but if you don't want to do that, and you scribble something down, I'll read it, and then I will read it back on Friday, do you see? But there isn't any homework, so I can't assign anything. Okay.
Thank you.